Good afternoon, everyone. It's Dr. Nigro again, our next episode of Psychology Unplugged. Thanks for another fun week in this new year of interacting with so many people. It's been an absolute pleasure. This is the highlight of my week, enjoying to do this podcast. Julie's laughing in the background because she says I was way till the last minute, but I do, as our population has grown, I've become more diligent with thinking of topics and responding to people's requests. So a heartfelt thank you to everyone who follows our program. And I'm slowly figuring out Instagram. And I post some things and Julie's like, what are you posting? And she makes me take that down. So we're getting there. It's a fun process. But I know there's a lot of people... And I think this episode will touch on a lot of different topics. There's a lot of people who follow us who are in the field of mental health and who are, whether they're actively practitioners or they are current, we have a lot of current students. And an overwhelming consensus was, can you kind of share what this whole field of psychology is about? The advantages between myself and Julie, we represent the three dimensions of psychology because as a neuropsychologist, I have the background in diagnostics and testing, very well trained in cognitive therapy, and Julie has a strong training in psychotherapy as well, and obviously psychopharmacology. So whether or not she pops on, that's kind of her style. She ebbs and flows throughout the house. So the field of psychology, I remember my doctoral program taking a course in the history of psychology, which is really cool. And it goes back, you know, way beyond Freud and Adler and Jung. It goes back to the ancient Greeks. You know, something we use in cognitive therapy is the Socratic dialogue, how Socrates used to speak and lecture and teach, even though he was eventually poisoned with hemlock, but that's a separate story in and of itself. And, you know, throughout the evolution of the field, they would do things like timpaning, which was people thought that, you know, at that time you were possessed by evil spirits. They would drill a spike into the skull and the spirits would dissipate. We look at, if you ever watch old movies from Bellevue, people chained to beds and hosed down with cold showers. And I think we look back and say, oh my God, how archaic that was. And that's, you know, statistics. It's called a post hoc analysis. Because I think in 100 years, they'll probably say what we're doing right now is archaic because the field advances and because human behavior is, it's observable, it's predictable to a degree, but the mind is such a complex thing, and I think we've only had the DSM since the 1950s, I believe. And prior to the first DSM, there were only four disorders, none of which would be politically correct in any sense today. But the field, it depends on what you want to do and what your motivation is. The motivation of you going to any kind of healthcare profession is to help others. And I think if you are a student in the field and you're following our program, we've covered a wide variety of different topics. It's always good, I think, to have a strong background and training across a wide spectrum. I am by no means an expert in any field. Expert is something that is determined by a court. If you were to be an expert witness, I view myself, and I think Julie does as well, as perpetual students, constantly learning, constantly evolving, constantly growing, because this is an ever-changing field, especially in the field of neuroscience and all this other, you know, testing kind of stuff, what I specialize in. But in and of itself, it is a field designed to understand, to predict with some degree of measurability, human behavior and to help people navigate through a murky world of thoughts and emotions and behaviors. And this goes across all disciplines, whether you are a social worker, whether you are a licensed mental health counselor, whether you are a nurse practitioner, a psychiatrist, a neuropsychologist, a clinical psychologist. This is the field of dealing with people. So if you don't get along well with people, it's probably not the best field to get into, because this is a, you know, this is a people-driven business. But it requires, I think, a very strong educational background. And if you're in school, you want to make sure that you are going to a program that is accredited by the APA. Because the goal of education is, one, to prepare you to go out and to be an independent practitioner. And secondly, you want to make sure that your education allows you to become licensed. And I know that we have a very blessed to have a worldwide audience. I don't know what licensing requirements there are in other parts of the world. But that's something that you would take up with your individual board in whatever state or country that you're in. So it's really important. And I have had people who have spent a lot of money doing online programs realizing that they can't get licensed. So please, if you're in school, make sure that you get a internship. Your education, your internships, your practicums are APA accredited, or at least APIC accredited. Those are really important things in terms of your clinical training. But being a student, I remember it was my freshman or sophomore year of undergrad. I was immediately drawn. I thought medicine was the route I wanted to go, in neurology, and I was just fascinated. I don't know if it was like an introduction to psychology class or my first neuroscience class, but I was hooked, and I had a passion for it. And I think if you have a passion for it and you have the skill set, you will learn to love what you do. And I've said this before, I'm very blessed and humbled that I never feel like I'm working. It is a lot of work, but I'm blessed. I never feel like I'm at work. I mean, I love what I do, and if you have that, embrace that mantra, the financial resources will come. And now, you know, is your motivation to make a lot of money? Is there an opportunity to make a lot of money in this field? Absolutely. It is a great field to get into now, because with the pandemic, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. There are not enough providers. And I can speak this probably on a global level from talking with people across the globe in many different nations, that there are not enough prescribers. There are not enough neuropsychologists, because the wait lists in Massachusetts here are like 3, 4, 5 years, depending on insurances. Therapists, I used to be able to just text in real time, sending you Amanda, sending you John, sure, get them in next week. They've been taking patients or have wait lists at 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 months. And the pandemic brought mental health really to a bigger forefront. And telehealth was here prior to the pandemic. It's just now here to stay as a mainstream. Now, I am somebody who likes seeing people in person. I am able to do neuropsych evals via telehealth, but I really have stopped that because I like the in-person process. And for the grace of God, I was able to do that through the midst of the pandemic. Julie does a lot of telehealth. You know, whether you do telehealth, whether you're in person, I think it depends on what issues you're dealing with, what the different disorders are, what the problems are. Some disorders you really need to be seen in person. Others, I think, can be dealt with, you know, via telehealth. So getting a strong education, getting good advisors, good mentors, that was something I was very fortunate to. Now, I wasn't a nerd, but I wasn't the party. I was the one who spent time after class. I was outspoken. I raised my hand. Actually, I didn't really raise my hand. I just would kind of blurt things out. I would question things. I think that's my mother's genetics coming through in terms of questioning everything. But I learned so much. And I embraced the knowledge, and I practiced it. And, you know, when you first start to work with it, you know, you have the educational piece, which you kind of get in your, you know, in your undergrad program. And you're really not working with patients, unless maybe you have like a job in mental health, or you're working as a CNA or something like that. But the whole evolution is to get to this point where you're on your own. And it's kind of scary. And it's kind of spooky. Because, you know, when you're going through your practicums and your internships, you have individual supervision, you have group supervision, you got somebody who you could bounce things off of. And it was, I remember, you know, my first therapy practicum, I wanted to use all the cool terms. You know, I wanted to say, oh, you have dysfunctional schemas, and what are your cognitive biases? And that's cognitive dissonance. And I think it was not an egotistical way, but it was just like, wow, I can say this stuff, and I know what it means, because I learned about it in class. I could tell you, as an active practitioner, rarely do I ever use those terms, but in my mind, I'm thinking of them. So, you know, it's fun when you kind of get out there and get your feet wet and start to see things. And then, you know, you go, you know, your master's program, you can get licensed, depending on the type of license. Again, I'm only speaking from the United States, like licensed independent clinical social worker, licensed mental health counselor. They can have individual practices at the doctoral level. You know, you can get all the insurance panels, and it's a blast. I think it's also good, like I said, to have a strong breadth of knowledge and training. You'll be, you know, you're going to take courses in behavioral theory, in psychopharmacology, in, you know, cognitive therapy, family systems therapy, physiological psychology, basic courses in testing. Testing is really relegated to the doctoral level. And if your desire is to do testing, like what I do, you would require a doctoral degree. There are some people that use what are called psychometricians, which are sometimes bachelor or master's level people, and they do all the testing for the psychologist and then give them the data. I would never, ever would do that, only because I place so much emphasis on behavioral observations, on watching people. And if you are a practicing clinician or if you are a student, one of the most fundamental things, independent if you're doing therapy, if you're a med provider, if you are a neuropsychologist, the structured diagnostic clinical interview is the most poignant and paramount aspects in the beginning of treatment. And I have one that I've put together and I've modified over the years. And I tell people, I have to ask questions a very specific way. And if I interrupt you, it's not because I don't care. It's just I'm building a puzzle and a picture in my head. And doing this as long as I have, I tell people that since I've got on my doctoral program, I write on the upper left-hand corner what I think the diagnoses are. And then I do the testing and I see how close I am. But the hard thing is to figure out, like ADHD, processing disorders, anything neurological, that I really need the data for, but from the psychiatric stuff, that is crucial to get the backdrop of information. And that's something you want to become really good at. It's not only through asking the questions and getting the answers, but watching how somebody responds to the questions. So if we're asking for any history of suicidal thoughts and somebody pauses, that's a red flag right there. You know, probe and go back. Self-injurious behaviors, homicidal ideation. So the structured diagnostic clinical interview is a crucial part of building the framework. And I think, you know, if you listen to the episode I did with Bruce Springsteen and psychology, I took one of his songs and did what's called a case conceptualization, where you're basically taking data and you're building like almost like a diorama, a metaphorical model, and you're constructing what do you think is going on. And then, you know, again, for you guys who follow, I'm going to say send them for a neuropsych eval because that's going to give you all the answers. But, you know, you really have the framework. Are you dealing with depression, anxiety, bipolar, schizophrenia, OCD, a personality disorder, behavioral disorders in children, intermittent explosive disorder, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, ADHD, processing speed disorders, oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder. You know, if you ask the right questions, and there are many tools out there. I've just developed one that I've took from like just an amalgamation of all my educational materials and just clinical experience, and just, you know, reformulated it over the years. And I think it's about 36 pages, but I'm pretty confident at the end of that I know what direction I'm going in, and the testing is there to enhance that. Psychopharmacology is another important aspect of training. Now, I don't prescribe meds, but psychologists in many states are now able to prescribe meds. And I'll be honest, I had contemplated going back to school to do it, but I realized my wife is a prescriber. She works in the office next to me. I just, you know, I'll do the diagnosis and she can do the meds. But it's really helpful. And I think what in our situation, what makes it very useful is we're able to consult with one another. Because I get a lot of people who ask, like, you know, you hear all this stuff every day, and what do you do? And self-care is such a huge part of working in this field, because I can tell you, you will hear things that your worst nightmares cannot describe. You will see things that you'd never imagine that you would witness except on maybe a television screen. This is real life. And, you know, people are being honest and they're sharing their backgrounds and they're sharing their truths. You're going to hear things and see things. Supervision is something that's important, and it's helpful that Julie and I are in the same field. And I meet with my colleague, who unfortunately is moving out of state, but we'll stay in contact via FaceTime, because you need to bounce ideas off. You know, we are human as well, and you know, I put it this way: at this point, there's nothing somebody could tell me that would make me be like, huh. But, you know, it will impact you. And I think you have to take a look at your own lives and your own trajectories and what are the emotional things that you bring into it. You know, so for example, if you have a history of abuse or trauma, unless that's resolved, trauma work probably wouldn't be a good fit, because it will evoke a lot of things. And there's something called transference and countertransference. Transference is when a patient projects their feelings and perceptions and cognitions onto the therapist. Countertransference is where the therapist projects those same things onto the patient. So it's really important to be mindful of that. You will sense it. You know, if you're looking at your schedule and you see, like, oh geez, Amanda's coming in today at 2, and your eyes are rolling, probably a good idea to maybe step back, talk to a colleague, see, you know, maybe what that's about. Is it a good fit? Should you continue? Whatnot. But as I was saying, having a training in psychopharmacology, it was really well trained in that. Again, I don't prescribe meds, but it's really important to know, because when you're asking somebody like what medications they've been on, it gives you a good sense of what other people may have been seeing. So if somebody's been prescribed a lot of antidepressants, you know, you're probably in a realm, there's definitely something mood-oriented going on. Or if you're seeing, you know, they've been prescribed lithium and Vraylar and Lamictal, you know, possibly bipolarity. You know, but I mentioned, you know, be wary of hospital discharge records. I can tell you, and again, doing diagnostics, no one's doing anything wrong. It's just I have the ability to do so much testing to parse things out, because sometimes people are given umbrella diagnoses like schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, and from running a psychiatric hospital back in Chicago, understanding the reasons for that so that the insurance would cover any class of medication doesn't mean that what's on the discharge paper is always correct. So, you know, ethics is another important part of working in mental health, because, you know, boundary violations happen a lot. So one of the most common causes of ethical complaints is you know, people bare their souls and they bare their deepest, innermost secrets. And this is not a friendship. These are not friendships where you're hanging out with people and sure there are people that, you know, that practice that way, but that's not the ethical way to do it. You want to maintain a healthy level of, you know, connectedness, but also to a level that you're not an enabling person and that you're not crossing boundaries. You know, people ask, like, what about self-disclosure? I think, you know, it's like self-disclosure is appropriate to the point of if it's clinically relevant. But if you find that you're using your patient as a therapist, that's maybe time to step back and talk to a colleague and get some supervision. But it's the field in and of itself has so many different avenues, and I think everybody kind of has their niche and what they specialize with, and I'm very proud and blessed to work with an amazing group of colleagues. Some focus on personality disorders, some focus on children, some do, focus on marriage and family. The vast majority kind of handle everything, but I think we all kind of have our favorites. I don't do it much anymore, but I primarily treat borderline. And there's just many people will be like, I don't want nothing to do with borderline. And some people just like the worried well, the anxious and the depressed. But I can tell you that my training and my experience was very rigorous. It was very intense. And there was no margin for error. And I was trained that, especially my neuropsych program, that, when you diagnose, you never come up with rule out. Rule out was a never do. The job of a neuropsychologist is to rule in, is to do the testing and come up with a definitive answer. And one of the hard parts of doing testing is giving the feedback, because testing is all designed to figure out what's wrong. So, again, the field, because it's so vast, and geriatrics is a field that is exploding just because of population, baby boomers aging out. That's a very specialized field. So you break it down pretty much. So if you look at, like, on my Psychology Today page, I check off every possible disorder. It's only because I do diagnostic. That does not mean I specialize in everything. I do not specialize in everything. I don't think I specialize in testing. But in terms of a field itself, good mentors, good professors, accreditation, those are key parts. And those, the mentors and the interns, and it was scary when the first time I did testing. I was like reading the manual, like, did I do it right? And second guessing myself. And, that's a natural part of the process. I remember, I'll tell you a story. I remember I was administering the block designs I think it was my master's program. I was administering one of the subtests of the IQ test, and I didn't even have the stimulus book. And I met the professor was in a different room, and I sat there and I didn't have any of the stuff. And she's looking at me like, okay, let's go back and figure this out. So, it's scary if you're a clinician in this field, when you first get that first time you're with that person, it's scary. I know Julie kind of had that same fear and experience when she, got her license and was, had the ability to prescribe, and sat down, and she started it. Where we met we worked in a larger community organization where we're chronically mentally ill, dealing with more like schizophrenia and bipolar and stuff like that. And, I don't know if she wants to jump on and talk about her experience, but I remember just from our dialogue that was kind of eye-opening, because when you're given that license and you're an individual practitioner, you are totally responsible for the person sitting in front of you. So I'm going to let her pop on.
I will. I'm so sorry. I'm not feeling up to par today, so I'm a little tired, and so I'm kind of resting this Sunday. So if I sound a little hoarse, that's why. I just want to talk about, reiterate, mentorships are so important and valuable. And, when you're in grad school, I went to grad school two different times. One, I got a degree in clinical mental health and psychology. And the second time, I got my master's in nursing and became a psychiatric nurse practitioner. Not knowing exactly what you want to do with the field, but just having a knowing that you belong in the field somewhere is very normal. And it will unfold just like that little metaphor I got out of some book somewhere about, like, when you're at night, when you're driving to California from the East Coast to the West Coast, and you're driving and it's nighttime, your headlights can only see, 100 yards, maybe not, I don't even really know, but, and you can't see past that. But once you reach that spot, it kind of unfolds. So, and the career path will unfold. And you'll be sometimes very surprised. I think sometimes people really know exactly what they want to do. I thought I knew exactly what I wanted to do when I got my first master's. I entered a program at Lesley University that profoundly changed my life. It's actually a wonderful program that is well known worldwide now for their it's holistic, but it's also expressive therapies, meaning the work with children, with art, and expressive therapies is their, and education is their jam. But what I learned there was to change my life forever. The graduate professors there were amazing. They taught all of us to treat ourselves use ourselves as an instrument. That was a profound game changer for me because the style was not, it was clinical, very clinical, but it was also, when Kaur mentioned transference and countertransference, it trained me very well to handle that and recognize that. That was what you use yourself as an instrument when you're a therapist. And it's their program, I think, is quite genius. And the mentorship that I received, it was wonderful. And when you use yourself as an instrument, you are paying attention while you're sitting with a client, and you pay attention to what's coming up for yourself in the moment, in every moment, and that you're always checking in with yourself to be very aware of what you're going. So I had to do a lot of soul searching. I had to do a lot of healing. I had to deal with demons. I had to deal with all of my insecurities. And I thought I was going to specialize, because I've mentioned before that I was bullied severely in public school when I was growing up, when I was very young. And I'm okay now. But my mission was I'm going to work with people who are bullied. You know, that was what I thought my specialty would be. Well, turns out that was the most difficult thing for me to do. It was almost like I had so much experience being bullied that it was a lot of extra work for me to actually sit with somebody who is currently being bullied. I found myself not coming a little unhinged and not feeling super grounded in those ones. So I thought I was going to be so useful in something I personally experienced. Not so much. And then my career evolved after that when I worked at an inpatient facility and then a partial day program. And I worked as a therapist, a caseworker. I worked in utilization review, did insurance. I did a lot of different things. I worked with adolescents. I worked with adults. And I also thought that I wanted to work with children, but my mentor at the time, one of my mentors, great mentors, Mark Pesciotto, and also Sandy Hannon Engel, they were profoundly, you know, changed my career path, especially since I was at the precipice of not making a lot of money and I couldn't support my lifestyle. I had two children. I was a single mom. And I realized that at that time with my degree, I wasn't going to make the money that I wanted to. And I wasn't chasing money, but I needed to make enough to, you know, keep my home and, you know, raise two children. And so at that time, I was working in an inpatient unit, and we had pharmaceutical companies would come in and they'd do the lunches and all that jazz. And I was very taken and very impressed with some of the presentations that I saw regarding pharmaceuticals. So I thought, oh my God, maybe this is what I'm supposed to do. And I met a lot of the pharmaceutical reps. So, and that was very big at the time that I was a therapist too. It was a very sought after job. They made a lot of money if they were successful. I tried so hard. I applied for every job you can imagine. I probably put out, in those days, you literally mailed applications, there or emailed applications. But and I remember getting close to getting one job at Bristol Myers Squibb, and I didn't get it, and I was devastated. But you know, what happened after that was that I wound up working a partial day program, and my mentor Sandy Hannon Engel turned to me. She was a psychiatric nurse practitioner. She's also a doctor. She also has her doctorate, holds her doctorate in neuroscience. And she also developed a huge DBT program here called North River. She is an amazing woman. If you're listening, Sandy, shout out to you.
You crying again?
Love that woman. So she would sit in her chair at her desk, and the therapist that I work with, Abby, was awesome. Kara, still friends with to this day. All wonderful people, colleagues, like, you know, my work family. Talk about an incredible group of people. Rayanne was also one of them. Donna Feeney, who I still am very close with. And so all these wonderful people, they were my work family. And Sandy swiveled around her chair. She was a wise ass. And she looked at me. She's like, why didn't you just do what I do? Why are you going, why do you want to sell meds? I don't get it. Why don't you just do what I do? And my friend Elsbeth Ebby was applying to the program at Mass General. And I was like, what do you mean? And she's like, Julie, you can do this. And I never thought I could do it. I didn't think I was really smart enough. I mean, to be honest, I dreamed of it. Honestly, I thought, wow, that's a real dream. When I worked at McLean in Franciscan Hospital, which is the children's hospital at McLean in Brighton, it was all children and adolescents. It was quite an amazing program, and I started to seriously think about it, and I decided to apply. And I realized I had to become a nurse first, which that really didn't, that kind of stole my thunder a little bit, because I passed out during a liver biopsy. Okay. I'm not a surgical nurse. I can't deal with vomit, you know, the whole shebang. I get queasy, and needles, forget it. So, but I got in. And it was like, I swear to God, it was like I got into Harvard University. That's how it felt like for me. I felt, and I was in my early 40s. Okay. So when you talk about a career trajectory, I was an at-home mom for many years, and I went back to school because, you know, something led me to, you know, I'll maybe discuss that at another time, what led me to become a therapist. And I wound up getting a dual degree. And I worked my ass off, but it suits me well, because I will always have that hat. I went in, I took a right, you know, instead of falling through. I didn't even sit for the exam, you know, the LMHC exam. I didn't even follow through with that because, you know, my mentors were saying, you don't really need it if you're going to go prescribe meds and become a nurse practitioner. If you have the degree, you can do both. So I'm like, wow, you know, that's great. So I always wear the hat, you know, and I wear my mother hat too sometimes. Talk about countertransference. But anyway, so I got in, and it was like 3 years of intense. I describe it as strapping into a rocket and, you know, shooting to the moon. And it was 3 years, and it was rigorous, and it was very difficult, but it was an amazing experience. The people I still have, Christina Zena, she's a dear friend. She was with me on that journey. So was Ebby. And, you know, I can't tell you how much that's changed my life, because all I really ever wanted to do was help people. But I was always that person that everybody came to. You know, I was always that person who wanted to talk to me. And a lot of people think that that's what it means. You know, I know somebody who wanted to be a veterinarian, and I know that I wanted to be a veterinarian. But in reality, I could never be a veterinarian because I love animals too much, and I could never put one to sleep. Like, I, you know, animals make me nuts. Like, I cry at the drop of a pin when it comes to animals. So then I wanted to prescribe to kids, And then I realized, well, I was in the program. No, I don't want to prescribe to kids. I'd rather do, you know, work with adolescents. Okay, or adolescents than adults. But all along this unwinding road is you're going to find all the answers and ask lots of questions. But pay attention to those professors that really, you'll feel it. You'll know it. It's a spark. Bob Fox was he was a professor at Smith and also at Lesley. And he was the most genius professor that I had ever met because he was so passionate about personality disorders that he taught us in such a way that it was poetic. He used just the literature that he used to describe in his language, and it was like when the course was over, half the class was like, we need to go on. Like, what else can you do for us? Because this was so amazing. So it really gave me an understanding it gave me the understanding of what a personality really is and how they work and how it's not someone's fault and how it's not a flaw per se. It's more like knowing a personality style. And that was something I really respected because it wasn't like toxifying the disorders at all. It was explaining them in such a way that you were reading a great novel that you couldn't put down. I can dig up all my, you know, it's on my bucket list of things to do that I've been on my list of things to do for about 10, 15 years, but I could pull those up and I know Winnicott was one of them. And there are all these writers that write about personality disorders that are so fascinating and so beautiful that it left an impression on me. And I carry that hat as well. So that's why I do work with people with personality disorders, Dreyer. And I'm okay with it. I mean, the people who have insight, the people with personality disorders that have come to terms with it, that have insight, that want to work on it, those are the people that you can help. Again, and some people really like to work with addiction. Addiction is really, in my opinion, is masking something else. I think people truly become addicts if they've been injured. They get hooked on opiates because they're in chronic pain. Then they get shut off from their opiates. Then they go out and find them on the street and the heroin. And it goes on and on. You've read about it in the news. It's a talk about a pandemic. It is virtually, it's a devastating situation. And I've worked with them along the way as well. But I always look at that as dual diagnosis. If someone starts, you know, it starts in high school or adolescence, you know, when someone needs to have a drink or two to feel comfortable, you know, a little less inhibited. And then the marijuana and, you know, everybody's different. But, and I'm not saying marijuana is a gateway drug. Can't say that in the state of Massachusetts because I take gummies. But sometimes, but it's legal in Mass. It's not legal all over the United States. But I do know this. I've worked with addiction enough to know that there's usually something else going on. There's usually an anxiety disorder. There's usually a depressive mood disorder. Bipolarity is famous for addiction. Schizophrenia as well. And Cora mentioned that I work mostly via telehealth. But when I worked with, I don't work with the chronic population as much anymore. When I worked at my last job, I couldn't imagine doing telehealth really. And we did it over the phone during the pandemic with our company. Thank God we still stay connected. But I could never really imagine meeting someone in person, not in person, that had schizophrenia. It's very important to observe people who struggle with any kind of psychosis because you can't see that really on telehealth. I mean, not in my opinion. That needs to be dealt with, I think, in person. And, you know, you can see people's eyes shift to the left, to the right, to wherever they're hearing. That you can see, literally see the behavior of people responding or trying to ignore an internal stimuli, and the internal stimuli would be auditory or visual hallucinations, being the most common in schizophrenia, but not only. There's tactile, there's
gustatory,
olfactory. So olfactory is smell. As if you're not in the medical field, you might not know olfactory is the smell, that people smell things that aren't really there, and gustatory is what stomach?
Taste.
Thank you. Forgot that one. Whoops. So anyway, I'm really happy with how my career has unfolded, and I'm totally grateful to all of the people who had a hand in that. And I'm so grateful for our clients, our patients, because they teach us everything. You know, they're my teachers too. I'm not just sitting here. I'm learning from them, and I learn so much from my clients, and I am super grateful for that as well. And all my career, I've learned from my clients. And lastly, I would say definitely you need, you know, when you get out of school, supervision, you don't really have it as much anymore. You're not really meeting. Unless you're at a very cool facility like McLean or, you know, Mass General, where they actually do rounds. Most agencies don't do rounds. Rounds are amazing. That's when all the disciplines come together and they talk about every individual in a case. Every place should be doing rounds. But you have to make your own rounds. In private practice now, it's amazing how collaborative we are with our colleagues. It's just like an enormous work family. I am so grateful to amazing, I couldn't even name them all, but someday I will. I probably have already. But the all different disciplines that we're working with right now, it's just truly amazing. And it's sad that there is a shortage, because these people are, you know, we need more of you. Honestly, we really do. And you're never alone. That's what you always have to remember. When I first went into therapy, like I said, I thought I was going to do well with people who are bullied. Not so much. I realized in medicine, I didn't want to work with children, for a whole host of reasons. I'll explain another time, usually because the parents are a lot. No offense. I'm not offending anybody out there. And the other is, when I got out on my first day at work prescribing, I think we all felt like, really? Like, oh, and you just roll up your sleeves and you just do it. But you're never alone. That's the most important thing. You have to have colleagues. You have to have support. You have to have that. And that has literally saved me. And, you know, from burnout, it has saved me from questioning myself. It's always important to ask questions, and all of my colleagues are the same. We're all the same with each other. You know, whether they're doctors or they're nurse practitioners, they're asking questions, you know, to each of us. It's called being colleagues, and it's important because not everybody, I'm not an expert. I have a specialty, but I'm not an expert, and I'm always learning. I also want to comment on the post. Sorry, gotta say it. The post with Robert De Niro. I like Robert De Niro. I liked his movies, not all of them. I find him like that violent mafia guy actor, so I don't really like violent movies. And I know he's just acting. I think he's kind of a rogue personality out there, politically speaking. I do. I'm not even saying where I stand politically. It's not really the point. But what he's saying in that video, I kind of disagree with, or I half agree with, half don't. He's saying, when things are calm, be wary. No. When things are calm, be joyful, be blissful, and don't be wary. People who have anxiety are wary. People of PTSD are wary. No. When things are calm, enjoy the calm. And when things in the work is when things are crazy, try to be calm. I think the flip of that. So I disagree with that. And when Cor posted it, I usually like all of his posts. So I didn't like I didn't like it on purpose. I almost commented like, this isn't right. But I figured I'd say it to a couple million people rather than, you know, I think we have maybe, I don't know, at this point, maybe 900 followers, just shy of 900 followers. So I wouldn't reach the broader audience. And not everybody's on Instagram. So I thought I'd say that just out loud. And the circle story that he did was Call Your Parents. Core was blessed. You know, a lot of us are blessed with wonderful parents. Some parents aren't that great. Okay. Some parents, there's been just a lot of toxicity and there needs to be healthy boundaries with that. So if you are dealing with any kind of thing like that, don't feel shame or guilt about that particular post. That's coming from a son to his parents, because Core literally had the most beautiful parents and the most perfect parental situation. And that's why he posted that, because they're gone and he appreciates them even more. So that's why he shared that. Not that we have to explain anything, we don't, but I did want to just say that, you know, just being the advocate here, the opposite advocate, I hate devil's advocate, opposite advocate here, is like those of you who are struggling out there trying to build, you know, maintain healthy boundaries with parents that are considered toxic or not safe. Just don't take that post personally. Thank you guys. And that's a wrap. Gee, I thought I was only going to talk for 5 minutes and I wouldn't shut up.
I didn't think you were going to talk at all. So I have to run posts past Julie now before I post them on Instagram. I'm like a petulant child. They relate to different people. So hopefully this was an informative episode. Again, it's based off of a lot of people in the field, a lot of people who are navigating their way through the field. And I agree with Julie. You'll find your way, just like with her and with myself. I found my niche, my passion with testing, diagnostics, personality disorders. If you guys want to talk in more detail, I've really enjoyed speaking with a lot of people with questions about going into the field. Self-care is crucial. I do 6 days a week, two, sometimes three evals a day that are 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 pages. I'm mindful of that, but self-care is very important, and I cannot stress that enough. Independent of what area you are in the mental health field, you're never alone. We have a unique situation because we're both in the same field, so we can bounce things off of each other. It does sometimes feel very lonely at times, but you have an incredible responsibility. Because somebody's literally putting their life in your hands. And always err on the side of caution if you think somebody's a danger to themselves or others. Never ever second guess that. So if you want more details and more specifics into our individual professions as a doctor who does neuropsychologist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner or psychotherapy, reach out to us. We can be happy to talk to you guys on a more individualized basis, but it's an amazing field. It is a privilege to work with people. We take our jobs very seriously. I'm much more unconventional than Julie is, but I think it fits with our personalities and our styles. But when we get those texts that, hey, I made my first therapy appointment, or thanks for doing the podcast and opening my eyes, that makes this all the worthwhile. So until we talk next week, feel free to reach out to me at Psychology Unplugged. Psychology Unplugged at Outlook.com. Get a hold of me through Psychology Today. Follow us on Instagram at Psychology_Unplugged_. Contact me directly, 617-750-9411 in the East Coast, in the United States. Until next time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other. Send me lots of questions, send me topics. I appreciate it, and I will talk to you guys. Thanks. Bye.